Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm Magnus Tiefold. Our current coronavirus COVID-19 restrictions here in BC, and lots of controversy happening about that, with businesses and restaurants refusing to abide by rulings and people getting upset. And of course, there is the general anxiety about the new variants and how quickly they're spreading, and ICU admissions in hospitals. But today it's not going to be a very heavy COVID-19 show. We are, of course, going to start off with the global coronavirus update with news from around the world. But after that, we're going to be talking to SFU Professor Andy Hira about geothermal energy and its potential as a clean energy source for British Columbia, but also how it's held back by subsidies for the oil and gas and fossil fuel industries. Front Burner takes a look at life under ISIS in eastern Syria. We don't hear about the war as much these days, but the problems still exist, and they're going to take a closer look at that. We also have Bird Note, some music, and lots more.
This is the coronavirus global update on Tuesday, the 6th of April. I'm Nick Miles. North Korea pulls out of the Tokyo Olympics after an increase in cases. New Zealand and Australia announce a quarantine-free travel bubble, and restrictions ease in Portugal and the United Kingdom. North Korea has become the first nation to declare that it will not take part in the Tokyo Olympics, citing concern about rising COVID-19 cases in Japan. Our correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes says many other nations are watching the case numbers closely.
Infection rates have started to rise again, particularly in western Japan around the city of Osaka. It looks like we're seeing a number of different variants of the virus have also entered Japan. Many experts here have said they are very concerned about a fourth wave, and that if these new variants really start to spread amongst the Japanese population, then we could have a much bigger wave than the previous ones, because Japan's population is not only elderly, but it is pretty much completely unvaccinated even now. Vaccinations of over 65-year-olds in Japan only began last week.
The Indian capital, Delhi, has become the latest state to announce a nighttime curfew as part of fresh measures to tackle the coronavirus. On Tuesday, India recorded nearly 97,000 daily cases, a day after the numbers exceeded 100,000 for the first time. Most of the new cases are in the western state of Maharashtra. The nighttime curfew will last until the end of the month. The Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, has announced that quarantine-free travel between New Zealand and Australia will start on the 19th of April. Speaking at a news conference, she said that successful management of the coronavirus over the last year meant that conditions had been met to allow a two-way travel bubble. She insisted it could all be done while still minimising the risks.
This is an important step forward in our COVID response and represents an arrangement I do not believe we have seen in any other part of the world. That is, safely opening up international travel to another country while continuing to pursue a strategy of elimination and a commitment to keeping the virus out.
The World Bank estimates that Africa will need about $12 billion to buy and distribute enough vaccines to slow transmission. In a paper written with the International Monetary Fund, the bank argues developed nations should extend a moratorium on debt repayments offered to the world's poorer nations. Meanwhile, in Tanzania, the new president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, has announced a new approach to the pandemic. Her predecessor, John Magufuli, often dismissed the presence of the virus and encouraged prayer as well as the use of herbal remedies. President Hassan has announced a panel of medical experts who will advise the government. France has taken urgent steps to ramp up its national vaccination campaign by opening new facilities that are being called vaccinodromes, run by the fire service and the Red Cross. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
With the whole of France in lockdown since Saturday and for 4 weeks, the government's pushing ahead fast with its vaccination programme. The aim to be sufficiently in control of the virus by the end of April, for some restrictions gradually to be eased in May. The 38 mega vaccination centres are central to the campaign. At the Stade de France, they're hoping to vaccinate 10,000 people a week, mainly from the Seine-Saint-Denis department north of central Paris, which is one of the worst hit in France. Other well-known stadiums, like those of the main football teams of Lyon and Marseille, are also being used as centres. The government says it's on target to have vaccinated 10 million people with at least one dose by mid-April, with 10 million more a month after that. But there are still worries about the flow of deliveries, as well as about the resistance that many people are continuing to express towards the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Portugal is easing its lockdown restrictions 2 months after the country faced one of the worst outbreaks of COVID. New infections are at their lowest level since August. Smaller shops with a street entrance can now open, and outdoor seating will be allowed at restaurants and cafes. More children are going back to school, and a domestic travel ban has also been lifted. Here in Britain, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has confirmed that more sectors of the economy in England will be allowed to reopen next week. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
Across England, from next Monday, whole areas of life that have been forced to remain closed for months will now begin to open up. The Prime Minister announced the relaxation, saying the roadmap to reopening is on track. Boris Johnson warned people not to be complacent, so social distancing restrictions and limits on how many people can meet up remain in force in England. He's also urged people to make use of rapid home testing kits that will be given out free to anyone who wants to try to identify those who have COVID but no symptoms.
Damian Grammaticus, and that was the Coronavirus Global Update.
We'll be talking to SFU political science professor Andy Hira about geothermal energy in just a moment. But first, let's take a look at the Vancouver weather. Pretty nice day out there right now. It's about 4 degrees as we speak, but it's going to be mainly sunny with a high up to 12 later today. Clouds coming in a little bit in the evening with lows down to 5. Tomorrow the rain comes in. It's going to be bit of a wet day, but it's clearing in the afternoon, cloudy overnight, and then bit nice on Thursday, bit wet on Friday, and then it's actually looking pretty good for the weekend. So that's your forecast for the week. Andy Hira is a political science professor at SFU and part of a multidisciplinary team looking at alternative energy sources, and particularly geothermal and its potential as a clean energy source, and also how government policy that really favors the fossil fuel industry is holding back development of this energy source. Thanks for joining me today, Andy. This is Andy Hira, who's a professor of political science here at Simon Fraser University. And you've just published a report on geothermal power in British Columbia. Can you tell me a bit about that? And you have a co-author?
Yeah, my co-author is Nostrin Arianpu. She is an adjunct professor at the Faculty of Environment at SFU. And it's part of the ongoing work that the research group that I had is doing, which is called the Clean Energy Research Group. The idea behind the research group is to bring together engineers and social scientists and see if we can start to tackle some practical problems related to climate change transition.
So it's a cross-discipline group working on this?
Yeah, that's exactly the idea. We also have a business prof, and the principal idea is that we need a cross-disciplinary approach to solving these climate change problems. Technical fixes and policies that aren't related to finance or a business case aren't really practical for policymakers.
Great. So what is geothermal energy, and how is it harvested?
Sure. Geothermal energy is simply heat that is ubiquitous to the core of the earth. As we all know from seeing volcanoes, when there are tectonic fissures, that natural molten heat can start to dissipate. And so in certain areas of the world, especially where there is a meeting of different tectonic plates, which is the case with this Pacific Rim that British Columbia is on, there is a possibility to more easily tap into this natural heat that's emanating from the core of the earth. And so geothermal is a natural source. Once you have that heat, you can use it directly to heat homes or hot water or for cooling, or you can use it to create steam and create electricity from that steam.
Right. So what advantages does BC have in using this energy resource?
Well, the huge advantage that geothermal offers over fossil fuels is that it has zero emissions. It doesn't create pollution like fossil fuels do. Now, the cost will vary based on the site, but it's within the range. The estimation for geothermal is that it's within the range of being competitive with current renewable energies like offshore wind and solar. And the advantage it has over those renewable energy sources is that it's not intermittent. So once you have a viable field, you don't have to suffer from lack of sunlight or nighttime or lack of wind. Geothermal is always there for you.
So, I mean, we've been aware of the vast stores of heat within the earth for a while. What has prevented us from taking more advantage of it up to now, both, I guess, globally, but also here, maybe particularly here in BC?
Well, globally, actually, geothermal is starting to make some gains. We're all aware that Iceland has a huge, I think, over 90% of its energy coming directly from geothermal, including a direct use for heat. In fact, in Iceland, they heat up their sidewalks in winter with geothermal heat to melt the ice because they have so much of it. And obviously, not every place is so lucky as to have a series of volcanoes that make geothermal readily available. But what we've seen over the last decade is that along the Pacific Rim in particular, there are huge developments in geothermal in California, in Indonesia, in the Philippines, and in New Zealand. All of these jurisdictions are way ahead of where British Columbia is. And the principal obstacle, as we lay out in the paper, is really political. Although BC Hydro had some initial exploration in the early 1980s, it abandoned these efforts. And it, in more recent years, has turned to focus on Site C in terms of hydro being a readily available alternative. But what we show in our research group paper, in the first paper, is that Site C is going to be wholly inadequate for the electricity needs of British Columbia in the next coming 10 years. If we just think about the amount of electricity that will be needed for electric vehicles or electrification of LNG in order to meet our emissions reduction goals, both as a province and as a nation, we're going to need a lot more energy beyond Site C. And so that's where geothermal can come in and play a role. And the principal obstacle so far is, you know, a lack of interest by the province and particularly by BC Hydro, because Site C has kind of blinded them to the long-term planning process that's required. Mm-hmm. And B, they're just the main thing about geothermal is it's still an infant technology. And so it's still a high risk in the initial stages of exploration and drilling. And so when we look at these other jurisdictions like California, they provide heavy upfront public support and subsidies for this drilling and exploration process. In fact, most jurisdictions have used the public sector to map out potential geothermal reservoirs. That can be done fairly cheaply in BC because we have a lot of oil and gas technology, and in Alberta, and these abandoned wells and mines could be used at point to reduce the cost of exploration and drilling. But the private sector is not going to just jump in and take these huge risks. So in California, for example, a exploration drill could be supported by the public sector. They've already done the initial mapping. And then if the promising well turns out to be dry, the private sector pays nothing. The public sector will take up that insurance cost. And if the drilling is successful, then the private sector pays back the loan to the public sector. So that's just one example of the kind of policy support mechanisms that are needed for geothermal. And the geothermal has this dual use, as we discussed earlier, that A, that it can be used for electricity, and B, it can be used directly for heating. And the heating part can be used in more shallow, less robust reservoirs, but it still has high upfront costs for development, not only mapping out the resource, but also it requires a certain amount of investment. And so when you're looking at it on a residential area or even for a commercial area, the public sector has to come in and sort of amortize that cost over a longer period of time it'll take to pay it off, just like you would for electric vehicles that we have subsidies for, just like you would for solar or wind. You know, unless there is support for these nascent technologies, the private sector alone is not going to be enough for them to take off.
Right. So to access this energy, we'd be drilling down to where we can find the heat. Is that how it works? And that's why maybe using old oil wells or gas wells is a benefit.
Yeah, that's right. So there are certain areas you would have to ask a geologist that are more promising to others based on the geography and their natural characteristics that would make them more liable to have geothermal reservoirs. And then these geologists will go in and start to do some measurements and test out the robustness of those fields. And then it would require some pilot exploration drilling to really see the extent to which those fields are consistent and how much energy is located in them and how easy it is to access it. So all that requires some, a good deal of effort and investment, and that's where the public sector has to come in.
Right. So when they're drilling down, I mean, they don't have to like drill down to like magma, do they? Or do you just have to find some heat?
Yeah. So the shallower wells can be used directly for heat because the temperature doesn't need to be that high, right?
Yeah.
So that heat can be used, those shallower drills can be used directly for heat, for hot water. And the brilliant thing about that is you always lose energy when you're transforming it into electricity. Mm-hmm. So if you can use it directly, we can eliminate a lot of fossil fuels that we're using for heating. And when you think about remote First Nations communities, many of which are reliant on diesel fuel right now, a lot of our utilities in the Canadian North have been reluctant, including BC Hydro, to invest heavily in solar and wind because of the intermittency problem. Mm-hmm. So these communities are still stuck on diesel at a very high cost. Right. And geothermal could start to displace a lot of that fossil fuel by using it directly for heating. When you're talking about electricity, you have to drill down quite a bit further. Mm-hmm. And Nasrin could give you more details about that because you need a higher heat level in order to produce the steam that then generates the electricity.
Right. So is there an environmental downside to geothermal?
No, if the environmental controls are properly put in place, there are no emissions. There's no effect on the water quality. In previous years, there were concerns that some of these, contaminants or chemicals that are emitted in the process of geothermal would start to leak into the water. But now that technology is good enough that you can have a closed system and those contamination effects are no longer a factor. And the nice thing, again, versus solar and wind is mm-hmm. you don't have above land use, right? Everything is below the surface, so you don't have the same backlash that you do with, say, wind farms or solar farms.
Okay. So this might seem like a silly question, but is this a resource we can deplete? Or is it just so vast that...
Well, every field will have a certain amount of readily available fluid. And then you would have to keep, the farther you drill down, the higher your costs go. Mm-hmm. So that's why this mapping exercise is really important. Just like an oil or gas or a fracking field, you would want to do some exploration and figure out how robust is that field? How many years will it last versus what is the cost of developing it? But in BC, we really don't know because we haven't invested the kind of money that would be required to map out these fields. Given where we are in terms of geography, though, most people think both BC and Alberta have an abundance of geothermal resources that could last, well into the future.
Right. So does a field get, I guess I'm trying, I think of the core of the earth being very large and very hot, and it seems, so I'm just sort of trying to understand how a field would get used up.
So if you think about the Earth as a sphere, right, the core of it would require hundreds of miles of drilling to really get to that heat. So what you have are these kind of fissures, right, in the geology. And what you're trying to do is find those fissures so that your drilling costs are reduced.
Right.
And when you can find those fissures, that's what allows you to get into that geothermal reservoir. The fissures are initially vertical, but obviously they go in a variety of directions like we have with fracking. And because we have these horizontal and diagonal drilling techniques because of fracking, it allows you to get into those horizontal spaces where that heat gets trapped.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is the potential of geothermal, not just in BC, but, we're, as a society and an economy, struggling to find, ways to replace the energy that has up till now being provided by fossil fuels primarily. And, as you mentioned, solar and wind, which are definitely coming on and producing more, do have issues around intermittency. They're not always available. You have to find some other way of storing the energy. So what potential and then we talk about, maybe nuclear is the way to go because that, provides, what is the potential of geothermal to actually provide that solution of providing energy that can be clean?
Yeah, I mean, I can't give you a percentage, but we have the problem of what we call baseload power. That is, at any given time, the capacity of your energy system should be able to reach, you know, every household in BC, or, you know, 70% of them during peak hours in the evening want that use of that electricity, and the sun is not shining, then you either have to have energy storage or you have to have baseload power where you can, you know, use a natural gas generator. And so geothermal can come in and play a significant role in providing that kind of backup energy when solar and wind aren't providing it. And so what the percentage would be, would it be 10%? Would it be 20%? It's hard to tell how much baseload power geothermal can provide in BC until we have better mapping of the resource. But there's no question that it can play a very significant role in reducing this intermittency problem. It can also play a role, as I said, in these remote communities in terms of direct heat in a variety of communities, and thereby reducing our use of natural gas for heat. The intermittency problem is a more complicated one because there are huge problems, as we see with the cost of electric vehicles, with energy storage. And that's the big attraction of hydro, even with all these cost overruns in Site C. Once you have a big enough reservoir, you can turn on the energy anytime you want. You just let the water flow whenever you need it. Yeah. With climate change, that's going to affect precipitation. And as we've already discussed, Site C alone won't be enough. So Site C is a huge battery, but ultimately, if we want to reduce our use of carbon, then we're going to have to find a cheaper battery source. Geothermal enough alone won't be enough. And there are huge bets and investments being put into new battery technologies, but so far they're still very expensive, as reflected in the higher costs of electric vehicles. So that is the essential problem with intermittency and why it can't be resolved. Another solution for intermittency is integration of energy systems. And right now in the U.S., almost every state has its own energy system. Every province in Canada has its own energy system. And when you think about it, right, if you had all a real concerted effort to integrate these energy systems, at some point, somewhere around this country, wind is going to be blowing, the sun is going to be shining based on differences in time and differences in weather. And so if you integrate systems, you also reduce this intermittency problem. So this also shows, again, you know, the marriage of the need to think about politics and policy as well as technical solutions.
Great. So overall, how does it compare on cost and environmental impact to other renewable energy sources?
Now, there's what they call the LCOE, which is the levelized cost of energy. And there are estimates, as I said, that would put the LCOE of geothermal within a range that is comparable to other renewable energies, such as solar, such as wind. And at its lowest end, competitive with natural gas. Elements of wind are now also competitive with natural gas. But it's very hard to generalize because every geothermal field, just like every wind site and every solar site, is going to have its own costs, right?
Right.
So in general, we can say it's competitive, but it's very site specific.
Right. So how mature is the technology and the techniques used? I mean, is there still lots of room for development and improved efficiencies in this area?
Yeah, it's kind of like electric vehicles in that sense, right? It's still in its infancy. And there isn't nearly enough. If we look at the amount of R&D that's going into renewable energies in general, it's a pittance. It's a tiny fraction compared with the amount of money that goes into oil and gas research. And the same for our tax system. Our tax system is still geared towards carbon lock-in, supporting the oil and gas sector through subsidies and tax breaks in order to, protect politics, basically, because of the power of the fossil fuel lobby. The IISD has documented this well in terms of Canada's oil and gas subsidies, but it's true in most countries. Even Germany, you know, one of the most progressive countries in terms of renewable energy is building a natural gas pipeline to Russia. So it's pretty hard for us to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels because of all their built-in political advantages.
Right.
And so there would be, we still need major investments in geothermal to really develop the technology. But because it's not big enough, it doesn't have the lobbying power to actually try to get those R&D subsidies. And we don't even have like a good streamline of personnel or research. There's a little bit of research going on in UBC and University of Calgary, but nothing compared to what is really needed for the market to develop. And so we're kind of in this chicken and egg problem. And that's the reason, you know, one of the main reasons why we wrote the paper.
Right.
Policy has to be proactive to develop these infant industries.
Is there political will or political interest in making that happen that you see? Or is that what you're trying to?
Yeah, there's a geothermal industry, but they haven't really been effective. And there are reportedly conflicts between them and solar and gas. So like any new kind of industry, these sprouts are coming up, but they're not well organized. Nothing compared to the fossil fuels industry in terms of its power.
Well, it seems like, I mean, you know, any kind of energy source that we can find that is free of emissions seems like something we need to be pursuing and with great interest.
Yeah. It's the first lesson I tell to my students when I teach my public policy course, which is policy's myopic. It's myopic because we have three or four year election cycles, right? It's pretty hard to separate the two. And so you really have to try to hammer down to the bureaucracy, to BC Hydro, hey, you guys need a long-term plan. They don't have a long-term plan.
Yeah. So any final words about where we need as a province to be going with this technology?
Well, I just would say that, you know, we're sitting on this gold mine of emission-free energy. And instead of having this continual debate about Site C, which has turned out to be a boondoggle, but there are a lot of sunk costs, we're going to need that energy from Site C, but we're going to need a whole lot more. Mm-hmm. And we're going to need 10 or 15 years to develop that energy. Right. And geothermal's got to be part of that mix. So why are we sitting on our hands when we have all this abundant, non-intermittent energy that's available to us, and some of which is available in First Nations areas and therefore can have a huge economic development benefit?
Yeah, it's really spread around the province where these points of access are. And
for sure.
You mentioned particularly in your report about how, you know, when it comes, it's particularly accessible for heating purposes for small communities. You know.
Exactly. And therefore offers a range of alternatives for the use of energy that solar and wind don't. And you don't have all that energy loss going to electricity and then electricity to heat.
Yeah.
It's low-hanging fruit if we would just seize it. Instead, you know, our province and our federal government is looking backwards in terms of, you know, discussing and buying pipelines and investing in LNG. You know, we should be looking forwards.
Thanks for talking to me today.
Sure. It's my pleasure.
SFU Professor of Political Science, Andy Hira. He and a colleague, Nestoran Ariampu, have just published a paper on the potential of geothermal energy as a clean energy source here in BC. We'll be posting this program on the CJSF website later today, and we'll include a link to that paper. You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Bird Note. These thin silvery calls coming from the forest belong to a survivor, the golden-crowned kinglet. This bird weighs 6 grams, about the same as 2 pennies, yet they winter as far north as Alaska and Nova Scotia. With short days, intense cold, and heavy snow, how do kinglets stay alive? Biologist Bernd Heinrich found that the kinglets move through the forest in small flocks and feed constantly at almost 1 peck per second throughout the short day. By doing this, they take in enough tiny caterpillars to maintain their internal furnace at 110 degrees Fahrenheit. And their insulation keeps them warm. Their feathers make up 8% of their body weight, equivalent to the weight of the clothing of an Arctic explorer. When night falls, The flock huddles together to conserve heat, another of their superb adaptations for survival. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein. Did you know BirdNote delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox? Sign up for our newsletter at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.
The northern Syrian city of Raqqa has seen a decade of civil war. It suffered under more than 3 years of ISIS rule and fierce bombing campaigns by the U.S.-led coalition forces aimed at rooting ISIS out. My colleague Margaret Evans recently traveled to Raqqa to report on the city that has endured so much. Today, a snapshot of who she met, what they told her about life under ISIS, and life after. Hi, Margaret. Thank you for making the time.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jamie.
Margaret, I wonder, could you start by telling me about what you saw as you drove into Raqqa? Can you describe the city to me?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that you see is a really devastating amount of destruction, which can be sort of disorienting because it looks like this giant moonscape of gray rubble everywhere. And then there are these little flashes of color, these pockets of life that seem, you know, even more out of place because they're in this vast theater of destruction. And, you know, in one neighborhood, I remember seeing a whole block of apartments just crushed by, you know, presumably airstrikes. The only thing still standing was a stairwell, you know, going up several flights. But then you'd see people sitting on a chair outside, a shop having tea, a kid on a bike, a horse and a buggy, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's, I think, that juxtaposition of destruction and normality, finding a way to coexist. There's not that much reconstruction going on from what I was able to see, but little bits of it here and there. I mean, they've cleared the rubble off the streets and things, but, you know, there are kind of concrete ceilings, you know, hanging down over alleyways here, there, and everywhere. It still feels quite fraught. And you also know that it still hasn't been cleaned of all of the mines and the booby traps that ISIS would have left behind. So you had to step very carefully.
Wow. For those who aren't familiar with Raqqa's recent past, what was the significance of the city to ISIS?
Well, Raqqa actually began the war. So back in 2011, loyal to the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, at least the tribal leaders in the city were loyal to him and they pledged allegiance. But by 2013, it had been taken over by opposition forces fighting against al-Assad. So we met somebody who was the director of what used to be the museum, and he told us that it was in that year, in 2013, that he lost a lot of the artifacts in the museum because these opposition forces were there, and there, you know, there was a sense of lawlessness because they were kind of fighting between themselves as well. Mm. And so ISIS saw that and saw this sort of power vacuum developing, and they took advantage of it. And so by 2014, they had declared Raqqa the capital of their, what they were calling their caliphate, to be followed by 3 or 4 years of just atrocious barbarism.
They can be seen parading in the town center in U.S. armored vehicles captured from the Iraqi army. Tanks, personnel carriers, pickups.
Those who don't go to prayers have their shops shut for a month and they're sent to prison. They're whipped. Every 2 to 3 days, they kill somebody and put the body on display.
Mm-hmm. And briefly, how did the city come to be freed from ISIS control?
Not easily. It was eventually taken on the ground by Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces. They are the militia, the army, if you want to call it that, in charge in the northeastern part of Syria, which is now an autonomous area. They call it the Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria. The acronym keeps changing, but it's basically the Syrian Kurds that, of course, were partnered in the fight against ISIS with, you know, international coalition forces, including the United States. And they're the ones who went in, but with airstrikes from the United States, some U.S. special forces on the ground.
Amnesty International now says several of those coalition strikes violated international law, that not nearly enough care was taken to protect civilians.
They fired 30,000 artillery. That's tantamount to indiscriminate strikes.
And that's why the city is so utterly destroyed, is that, you know, the civilians endured a terribly long period of intense bombing campaigns to try to get ISIS out.
And speaking of that atrocious barbarism that you were talking about, that the people were subjected to under ISIS, I know that you went to a place in the city called Paradise Square. And what would the square have been like even just a few years ago, back when ISIS was still in power?
Mm. Well, I've obviously only seen pictures of it, but people talk about it a lot because it came to be such a terrible place. ISIS, of course, turned it into this place of public execution, and people tell stories about being forced to come out and watch. They would use loudspeakers calling on people to come to the square. And there's kind of a circle of metal posts around the middle of it. And people say that sometimes if people had been beheaded, they would, you know, put their heads on these posts. I mean, really terrible, gruesome stuff. So, you know, obviously it was clearly a part of their reign of terror, you know, inflicting terrible memories and psychological scars on the people who had to witness this.
I can imagine that now that ISIS is gone, there are attempts to reclaim spaces like this that have such terrible memories associated with them. And so what does Paradise Square look like now?
Well, you're right. I mean, they've given it a facelift. It was one of the first things we were told that the municipal authorities who kind of came in to try to restore a bit of order tried to do. So they've put up some, you know, some white arches in the middle of the square. There's a new fountain. And then there are also some shops around the edges of it, you know, kebab shops. There's a sweet shop where they were serving up knefa, which is this really yummy, yummy dessert with syrup and cheese and pistachios. There are strawberry sellers out on the street. And at night, you know, people with their carts selling sometimes nuts and lighting up with little torches. And then there's this big, rather startlingly bright I Love Raqqa sign that they've put up there. And it's very incongruous. It blocks out some of the destruction behind, but not very well. And if ever there was a city that needed some love, this is it. But it looks strange to see it there.
Yeah. And speaking of this I Love Raqqa sign, I know that you met a young woman posing for a picture beside it. And can you tell me about her? Can you tell me about Amal?
Yeah. I mean, Amal means hope in Arabic. And she was a very hopeful young woman. She was there with her family. She was originally from Raqqa, but she's not living there anymore. She's 18 now, so she would have been quite young when ISIS took over. She was about 15 when the city was liberated. I asked her what life was like under ISIS, and she delivered this huge understatement of an answer, which was,
"Ma kanat hilwa."
Yeah, it was not beautiful.
Yeah.
When the Kurds took the control of the city, like, I mean, I could feel the beautiful taste of the life again in Raqqa.
She was wearing jeans, you know, a short jacket, very modern looking, a headscarf. And she said that she had to cover up fully, and not surprisingly, under the Islamic State.
So as for the woman, they would force like the niqab. the black uniform, and also like even the men didn't have a free will. Like if you wear a pant, they would say like, why you are wearing a pant?
But she was also, she did seem like a hopeful person. You know, she was there not just with her own child and her husband, but with the child of her brother who was killed, she told me. You know, at first she said he died in the war, and I said, well, how exactly? He stepped on one of these mines that was left behind.
Oh, that's so tragic. Margaret, I was hoping you could tell me about another person you met who is also trying to restore some sense of normalcy, a bookseller named Ahmed.
Yes, Ahmed Al-Kabur Mohammed, an 80-year-old, also a person I would describe as of hope in a way. He's got 11 children, some are living in Germany, and he said he opened that bookstore, which is where we met him. He opened it at the age of 16, and he ran it until the day ISIS came knocking on his door. And they came in and they looked at his books. They didn't like the covers on some of them. They questioned his religious credentials because of it. And he basically said, you know, he knew what was coming. And he said to them, look, I'm going to go to the mosque. You do what you need to do while I'm away. And off he went. And when he came back, they'd burned all of his books, except for the Quran.
That must have been devastating for him, this bookstore that he had been running since he was 16 years old.
Yeah, but, you know, he was also very philosophical. He said, you know, I thought to myself, they are destroying Syria from Qamishli in the north to Deir ez-Zor in the south. And I just told myself, I'm not going to cry over some books that ISIS wants to burn. And in a way, I think it's almost like an act of defiance to just say, go ahead. You know, I'll leave you to do it. But that's not what I'll be crying over.
What does Ahmed's bookshop look like now?
Well, it's pretty neat and tidy, but he doesn't have loads of books on the shelves because he says it's difficult to get books in Raqqa. And it's also, people don't have a lot of money to buy books. They're kind of, considered a luxury in sort of days of hardship, obviously. But he's very proud of what he does have on his shelves. He's got titles from abroad. He was very proud to pull out, Dostoevsky for us so that we could see that. And he sells writing books, or scribblers, for school kids' notebooks, I guess is what I'm looking for. He has a, collection of friends sitting outside in the sunshine outside his bookstore. They come around every day, older gentlemen, they drink tea. He insisted that we have tea and sweets. He was very, very generous and very proud of his bookstore. But he, a reminder of how deeply all of this has hit him is that he said to us, wait here. And he went off around the corner. I think he lived right around the corner. And he came back and he was carrying the sign from his shop that was full of bullet holes from the ISIS years. And he wasn't letting go of that. And he wanted us to see it.
Right. And so I can only imagine that, despite a makeover and an I Love Raqqa sign in Paradise Square, despite Ahmed being able to stock his shelves with books once again, the trauma of what happened there must run so deep. It must be everywhere, right?
Yeah, but lots of people didn't want to talk about it. You would say, how are you? How is life in Raqqa? And there was a spirit or stoicism that would come out. Yeah, it's okay. We're getting by. Some people talked about it. I mean, the museum director that I told you about, who is 70, talked about ISIS succeeding in destroying people's spirit.
They didn't try. They did it, actually. Yeah, when you see people like were hung out or tortured in the O'clock Square, and they like, I mean, they are beheaded there. So, I mean, that's like the most ugly picture that anybody like could see.
It was so horrible to have to witness what they witnessed, that they succeeded on some levels in destroying the spirit of the city that people are proud of. You mentioned before that people don't have the money to buy books. And, you know, I understand that on top of all of this trauma, there are also economic problems, right? And can you tell me about the economic situation many people in Raqqa find themselves in now?
Yeah, I mean, they find themselves in the same boat as all the other Syrians. That huge, unprecedented, people would say, currency crisis. Economic crisis taking place. It's partly connected to what's been happening in neighboring Lebanon with the currency crisis there, but it's also a decade of war, and we're hearing more and more reports of serious hunger in the country.
In any other life, Riam might be top of the class, sifting through the rubbish for scraps. A piece of rotten food is to be shared, health warnings ignored.
And the head of the International Committee for the Red Cross visited Syria last week and basically was saying that 80% of Syrians are now living in poverty. And, wow. You know, people go around with these huge bags of money because inflation is out of control. So you have to kind of have a big stash, a big pile just to buy some bread. And this is what people really wanted to talk about. They didn't want to say, let's talk about ISIS or there's no rebuilding. They were like, we people can't afford to feed their families now. It's a huge problem. And the market sellers were, you know, you'd go through the market. Lots of, you know, beautiful looking vegetables, date sellers and stuff like that, but nobody buying because they can't afford it.
And then I guess on top of all of this, this is a country that is still at war. Bashar al-Assad is still in power. And I wonder if people did speak to you at all about what they expect or what they hope for the political future of the country. Or are they just so caught up in what's immediately in front of them, understandably?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I asked people quite often whether or not they thought that the war in Syria was over, because some people say, you know, al-Assad has got it all wrapped up. I mean, he doesn't, and he would be in a different position if he didn't have support from Iran and Russia and has had that support since 2015. But people didn't like being asked that question. You know, they looked at you like, are you daft? Of course it's not over. And, you know, I asked it of Ahmed, the bookseller, and he said, look, he was careful to say he wants one Syria. That was kind of code for saying he doesn't want to be under control, the control of the Syrian Kurds forever. They're the ones who now are in control of Raqqa and other parts of the northeast, something like they would say 30% of the country. And he said, it's not because I don't like the Syrian Kurds. I just believe in this dream of one Syria that, you know, can accommodate all of the different nationalities. And I said, is that possible under the current leadership? And he said,
no, that's impossible. Unless, like, I mean, the whole system, the whole process is being changed, yeah, it will be fine. The people who are controlling there, like, they have dictatorship.
But people are worried about the immediate, and they are also worried, you know, in Raqqa in particular, that things might not be over, that there's still a lot of lack of security there. They'd say the Syrian Kurds are better than what they had before, obviously. But, you still don't see, for instance, people would say Raqqa used to be a party town before the war. You know, people said, oh, they think that people are hedging their bets, that some people leave worry ISIS might be able to come back. There are sleeper cells in the country. We have heard reports that, you know, they're still extorting people for money. There have been kidnappings. So it's still very uncertain. People are very unsettled about what happens next, and they don't know in 10 years' time who's going to be running Raqqa or the country.
I just want to give our listeners some numbers here. This is a war that has killed more than 400,000 Syrians, according to the most recent statistics from the United Nations. As you just mentioned, 80% of people living in poverty. 6.6 million people have fled the country. Another 6.7 are internally displaced inside Syria. And I wonder if you could tell me about one of those 6.7 million internally displaced Syrians that you met.
Yeah, I mean, it was a man who was at Paradise Square, you know, just beside the I Love Raqqa sign. And I went up to him to chat with my translator, and I just assumed that he was from Raqqa, and that it was the wrong assumption.
From Idlib.
You're from Idlib. When did you come here?
1 year.
1 year, because Idlib is pretty bad.
Very bad.
Which was sort of startling because I just hadn't thought about it. I mean, know about all the displaced, but you don't think that somebody might necessarily run from Idlib to Raqqa.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Hassan, and he really sticks with me because he's 30 years old. He had this little coffee truck where he makes extremely strong coffee. And he said that this was the perfect job for him because he could carry it on his back. He could go anywhere. So he's still expecting that he might have to move again. But he was also an example of all of the people, so many people whose lives are still on hold and their futures are just plucked away from them in a heartbeat. You know, he was studying law in Aleppo. He'd completed 3 years of a 4-year degree. But by the time the fourth year came around, it was too dangerous for him to travel to Aleppo. And that was the end of that dream. And there are just hundreds of thousands of stories like that. But again, he was full of regret. You could see it, but he wasn't voicing it. He wasn't feeling sorry for himself, which is always amazing because, you know, people are really, they've just had their futures taken away from them.
Mm-hmm. Margaret, thank you so much for this conversation and for this really important reporting along with our colleagues, Stephanie and Jean-Francois, thank you very much for bringing us these stories. We're really, really appreciative.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Okay, so before we go today, amid nearly 6,000 new cases of COVID in 2 days in Ontario, the medical officers of health from Toronto, Ottawa, and Peel region have joined forces to call on the province to implement further restrictions, including a full stay-at-home order. The doctors raised concerns about the rapid spread of variants of concern which are hospitalizing younger people and threatening the healthcare system's ability to deal with regular ICU admissions. Peel region, which includes Brampton, Caledon, and Mississauga, also ordered schools to close for the next 2 weeks. That's all for today. I'm Jamie Poisson. Thanks so much for listening to Front Burner. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
That's our show for today. This has been Speak Up, and I've been your host, Magnus Tiewald. We'll be posting a link to Andy Hira's article on geothermal energy in BC on our website later today. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for lots of great programming coming up here on CJSF, including Democracy Now!, in just a few moments.
A Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is a place to be, featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee. Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?